there are a lot of reasons for the collapse of the Roman Empire. But what interested the historian Kyle Harper is the role disease played in the story. Infectious disease, a series of pandemics, actually, he says, helped take down Rome. There are a lot of great characters in this story. One of them is an eloquent but sickly orator named Aelius Aristides.
He's one of the truly fascinating characters of the High Roman Empire. Trained in rhetoric, one of the great orators of his day. It was said that a oration that he wrote and basically mailed to the emperor Marcus Aurelius when there was an earthquake brought the emperor to tears. And it prompted the emperor to send a relief package to help rebuild the city. So it had a real effect. And they put a statue of Aristides up in the middle of the town. So he's a well-known figure. He would have been a kind of a celebrity in the middle of the second century. He was always sick in one fashion or another, but what makes him different from anybody else who was sick for his entire life in the Roman Empire is that he wrote volumes about it that survive. And so he wrote what amounts to kind of a medical diary or a dream diary. It's a strange record of his life that tells about his sicknesses and his attempts for cures and the appearances of the god Asclepius, who is the son of Apollo and the Romans and Greeks believed was the healing god, and the instructions that the god would give him on how to feel better, that he took quite literally and probably did a little more damage than good. There was nothing to relieve him, and his life was one of physical suffering. And I think that one of the reasons why he captured people's imaginations then and now is he's a human being who suffered. And so I think in that sense, we can think of him as emblematic of a society that was basically helpless in the face of infectious disease. For all the achievements of an empire like Rome, even those who were on the kind of ruling side of it were just vulnerable beyond our ability to imagine.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the height of its power, the Roman Empire was massive. Something like 75 million people lived under imperial rule. And Rome itself, the city, was something. At one point, a million people lived there. And we know this because the Romans counted the people and the money and the buildings. One inventory from the 4th century listed two circuses, 28 libraries, 856 baths, 46 brothels, and that's not to mention the 423 neighborhoods and 47,000 apartment blocks. But only a few decades later, the last of the Roman emperors was overthrown, and Rome was left with 10, maybe 20,000 people. Kyle Harper, of course, isn't the first to explain why the Roman Empire fell, but his focus is somewhat unique. Harper says the reasons for the collapse are complicated, of course. They're political and economic, but he also says Rome fell because of disease. The empire was hit by three major pandemics in its history, but also wave after wave after wave of major disease outbreaks. The thing is, Rome connected the known world. And it transformed natural landscapes, and that made it easier for virulent and devastating bugs to spread. Today in the program, we're talking about what pandemics were like in the ancient world. Kyle Harper's book is called The Fate of Rome, and he told us, first of all, we shouldn't see the Romans as the end of the ancient world, but the beginning of a modern one.
Well, I think it's easy for us to use very old ways of classifying the past. And so we're used to the kind of architecture of ancient, medieval, and modern. And it's easy to imagine the modern world with things like the Industrial Revolution and economic growth and the prosperity that we enjoy and things like the Scientific Revolution and public health and biomedicine as sort of fundamental differentiators from a more distant past. And I don't think that that way of imagining the human story is actually accurate. I think if you take a deeper time perspective and you think about the history of humans as the history of a species, then in a lot of ways, the last 2,000 or 3,000 years are a period of great continuity with a few, I would say, deep continuities like population growth, globalization, urbanization. And these are the trends that drive the evolution and emergence of infectious diseases. So one of the deep patterns of human history is that as we grow and encroach upon nature and build more interconnected societies and develop new transportation technologies, whether it's shipping or ultimately steam, ultimately mechanized, motorized, fossil fuel driven engines, whether it's airplanes, every time we make the human globe more interconnected, we are changing the ecological context of our pathogens. So I think when we look back at the Roman Empire, we shouldn't see them as sort of a on the other side of a divide from the modern world, but rather as sort of the first steps towards a modern world that's more globalized, it's more integrated, that has big cities. Think of the city of Rome itself, which is unique, but is probably the first human city to have 1 million residents. And so it's a leap forward in urbanization. You know, I think there are deep continuities between the more distant ancient past and the world that we inhabit today.
I think you were making a kind of offhanded reference to Monty Python's The Life of Brian. When there's that scene that people love so much where the people Judeans front or the whichever name that they've decided on, they're griping about the Romans and what have the Romans ever done for us? And then, of course, it's very funny because they start talking about what the Romans, in fact, did give to civilization, you know, the aqueducts and, you know, the litany goes on and on. But you say in some ways the answer is this. Here's what the Romans did for us. They got us sick. Talk a little bit about that. That's not all they did for us, but that's an important part of their legacy, I guess.
I think it is. And that is one of the great scenes in the history of film, I would have to say.
Yeah.
And every Roman historian loves that. Even when we don't totally agree with it. It's just great comedy. But the spin that I put on it is, what have the Romans ever done for us? Well, they got us sick. And one way, and I should preface this by saying it's very hard to know about the history of health. So we have to piece it together using whatever clues we can find. And one of the really exciting clues is bioarchaeology. It's colleagues who are trained in archaeology with a specialization in biology and know how to interpret skeletal remains as evidence for diet, health, and other, you know, labor, other things that affected the body and left their mark on people's bones. And one of the really basic, in some ways crude, but meaningful biological indices is simply people's stature. How tall were they? So when you're looking at people's stature, part of what you're seeing is how much meat they ate when they were a kid. But that's not all. You're also looking at what kinds of diseases did they suffer. People who bear a heavy burden of infectious disease, particularly in the first 20 years of life, have much lower achieved stature. In fact, infectious disease is one of the major determinants of achieved stature. And so people who suffer repeated infections never achieve the same kind of stature as people who don't. And so the length of people's bones, and most of the time bioarchaeologists will measure people's femurs because your femur is big and it's a good proxy for your height and it preserves really well. So there's lots of femurs around. And so archaeologists have created big data sets of femur length in the Roman Empire. And one of the really amazing things is that when the Romans come, people got shorter. And this happens actually in the heartland of the Roman Empire too, central Italy, which we actually know gets wealthier in this period. So people probably had more to eat. And so we can't necessarily explain, at least not very easily, that people got shorter because they didn't have the same levels of food.
And they were powerful. They were successful, but they were short. In fact, you mentioned people would have looked down on the Roman conquerors. When they came, they were mighty as a force, but they were not healthy, and they were not healthy because they were. You could tell because they were short.
Exactly. Maybe there's a little historical license here, but I think there's pretty good evidence for it. But you could imagine Julius Caesar, who actually was supposed to be tall, but leading his troops for the first time into Britain, or Claudius leading the armies of conquest into Britain and leading a big army of relatively short men against these giant Britons who lived these fairly healthy lives, probably did eat quite a bit of meat and didn't have the same disease burden. And nonetheless, the Romans conquered. But once the Romans conquered, they brought with them their diseases. They brought cities, they brought roads, and germs loved the cities and loved the roads of the Romans.
I want to ask you about, we'll talk about particular plagues that played out during the Roman Empire. But you also mention how all of this fits into a category, a period referred to as the Age of Pandemics. Talk a little bit about this, because this is, in some ways, again, as we were saying, the beginning of these big cities and these capitalistic systems and economic orders and stuff like that was the beginning of these big disease experiences. So talk a little bit about how this fits into a larger age of pandemics, as you put it.
Yeah, what a great question. And I want to give a kind of notice of a book that I love that's now well out of date, and that's William McNeill's Plagues and Peoples. And he has this wonderful chapter in which he describes the confluence of the disease pools of Eurasia. And it's talking about more or less the period that I'm interested in, when you see the rise of the Silk Roads and you see the explosion of trade and transport. And his idea that in some ways I build on is that this creates the ecological platform for disease events that were larger and more violent than anything that had come before. I think it's a great, I think it's an inspiring model. I apply it to the Roman period, which is the period that I know best. And I find it meaningful that in the earlier Roman period, which is quite well documented. So if you think of the later Roman Republic, which is probably the most famous period of Roman history, when you think about Pompey and Julius Caesar, if you go a little before that, think of the works of Cicero and the histories we have of Livy and so on. This is a very well documented period of Roman history. And if you look at the all the sources for Roman history, there is no evidence for pandemic disease. And a pandemic is a mortality event caused by an infectious disease that is spatially widespread. And it usually means interregional, so maybe covering multiple countries or even multiple continents. And I don't necessarily think that the first of the pandemics that I study, which happens in the 160s AD in the reign of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, and then historians call the Antonine Plague, I don't necessarily think that's the first pandemic that ever happens in human history. But I will say that in a very well-attested period of the Roman Republic and early Roman Empire, there is no evidence for major pandemic disease events. Then all of a sudden, there is a stunning amount of evidence for the outbreak of a disease that may have been smallpox, that was devastating, that killed, 7 to 10 million people just in the Roman Empire,
yeah,
and was probably the most deadly disease event in human history down to that time in terms of its absolute mortality toll. And so when I think about the age of pandemics, I'm describing a period that begins with that event, with the Antonine Plague. And over the course of the next several centuries, there is a series of these kinds of, you know, global or at least continental scale disease outbreaks.
It seems like one of the lessons, the reason an age of pandemics begins, I want to underscore this, because it seems like one of the lessons from this Roman experience is that there were diseases before, chronic infections you write about. But until humans started creating human environments, until they started moving land and transforming land and doing agriculture and extracting natural resources and cutting down trees, until that moment, pathogens were self-limiting. But after that moment, that's when we come in contact with wild animals, and that's when we seem to, and not, I'm oversimplifying here because there's obviously globalization and things like that, but one of the things that happened is once we started transforming land and exploiting natural resources and coming in contact with natural habitat, that's when things really get started in terms of this age of pandemics. Is that oversimplified, or does that get to it?
I think it's definitely bringing the right ingredients into play. But I think that some of those ingredients were at least partly in play long before. And I think there's always a deeper history and a deeper context. And in some ways, the unique human disease pool goes back to the very origins of humanity and our amazing versatility as a species in expanding beyond the heartland and origin of humankind, which is in Africa, and expanding across Asia and across the Americas and across Europe. And that brought us into contact with a uniquely wide range of potential infectious diseases. I mean, all infectious diseases originate in animals, and at some time scale, every infectious disease that we have comes from a wild animal. But what happens is that that once pathogens make that jump from, say, the wild animal host to humans, the nature of our societies, the level of population, the level of transportation and connection we have, puts them into very different circumstances. Let me give you a concrete example, which is the measles virus. Measles is amazingly contagious. It's actually more contagious than SARS coronavirus 2, which is pretty darn contagious. And measles runs a pretty quick course. So if you get it, you get sick, and then it runs its course and leaves you with immunity. So once you've had measles, your body has acquired immunity. You have the antibodies that will prevent you from contracting it again. So measles needs new hosts. And for a virus to survive, it has to get from one host to a new host who's susceptible. And measles is so fast and so contagious that it will go extinct immediately in any human population of less than 250,000. And this is a kind of pattern that probably repeats itself constantly. Humans come into contact with wild animals. We get new diseases like measles or like coronavirus, and they will quickly go extinct, except that they're are large human populations that can sustain the transmission and continually feed it new hosts. So human population growth has enabled the emergence of new diseases in a way that's really unlike any other mammal on planet Earth. And measles, I think it's amazing, evolved at almost exactly the moment when human cities became big enough to sustain the transmission of the virus. So one way to look at it is that we are hosts, and as we've expanded our numbers, we've sort of dared nature to take advantage of us, and pathogens are constantly trying, and we're always battling them back. And coronavirus is just the latest in a very long train of viruses that have tried to take advantage of us.
Kyle Harper, he's a professor of classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma. We're talking about his book, The Fate of Rome: Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As a kid, you don't really want to stick out. But for Pete Philbrook, his faith left him no other option. He was different.
There's always an explanation that you have to provide to these other kids. What'd you get for Christmas?
Well, this week on Preach, what it's like to grow up in a strict Jehovah's Witness household, going door to door in your hometown as a teenager, and yes, not celebrating holidays. That's Preach. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened when ancient Rome was struck with a devastating pandemic. More than one of these plagues, in fact, and dozens of other outbreaks. The historian Kyle Harper is with us to talk about how Roman civilization made the conditions of pandemics possible. It wasn't the only thing that made Rome fall, but it may have also made a big difference. Harper's book is called The Fate of Rome. I want to begin the conversation about the particular plagues in Rome, in the Roman Empire. I want to begin in the second century with this story, because this is really the sort of the pinnacle of Roman power, when it just seemed like the Rome was unstoppable. And I want to ask about Plutarch, because you write about him. He's the philosopher, of course, and he has this series of conversations, of moral conversations, where he poses this question about disease. And I wanted you to take us through this. And the question, I guess, if I understand this right, is, can there be new diseases in the world? Which means, is nature fixed and settled? Is everything that's going to happen to us already in some way in place, or can there be new diseases? Talk a little bit about this, because this was a really interesting way of thinking about how the ancients were talking about and thinking of disease.
Oh, you've said it very well. Plutarch poses this as the kind of question that educated Romans would have at the dinner table. Can there be new diseases? Because in some ways, it sort of grates against the tendency of the Greco-Roman mind that believed that, you know, the universe is perfect and complete and in some ways unchanging. It's hard to imagine. How could there be a new disease? Where would it come from? What would that mean? And even though it sort of grates against the tendency of the Greco-Roman worldview in some ways, they lived and had enough experience of the spread of different diseases that they sensed that there must be new kinds of diseases. And so they tried to understand how could that be. Now, their theory of disease was not based on ideas of infection. So they don't have germ theory. They don't have a way of understanding that they're microscopic little things that invade you and make you sick. Their basic theory is that the human body is a balance of the four humors, and health is achieved by the right balance between those. And so disease comes from anything that throws those out of balance. So poor diet, practice, not exercising enough or exercising too much or going to the baths too much or They have the idea that too much sex or too little sex will throw the bodily humors out of balance. So their idea of health is really based on balance. And so they have to explain new diseases, and this comes up in Plutarch. It must be something new that's throwing the body out of balance in new ways.
What was the Roman view of nature, the human relationship with nature? Because one of the things and this comes a little bit later in the story, Justinian, the Emperor Justinian's view of nature is really interesting, where there emerges this idea, these two conflicting ideas about how nature works. On one hand, people need to work with the natural order. Or the other view, the Roman view of the time, Justinian's view, is that nature was this antagonist that needed to be tamed and needed to be fought. Like, what was the bigger idea of how humans thought they fit in the idea of nature?
Yeah. You know, there's some main themes in the way the Romans think about the natural world. And there's a long tendency that's, like so much of Roman thought, indebted to Greek ideas that come before it, that nature is a model, that nature is peaceful, that nature is idyllic. Think of like pastoral poetry and literature that celebrates the kind of innocence of nature and sees the sort of idealization of humanity in the figure of humans who are living in accordance with nature, and that sees urbanization and civilization as inherently corrupt and corrupting. So that's sort of one concept. But another is that nature is dangerous. Nature is violent. Nature is disorderly. And that the project of civilization is to impose order on the wildness of nature. And I think that this is one of the main strands of Roman thought, and one of the main visions of Roman civilization is that humans should impose their will on nature. They should build a road through that pass. They should drain those swamps so that they can be turned into fertile fields.
They cut down forests. They transform natural landscapes. This plays a role. And you mentioned that by doing this, by altering the physical world around them, they sort of stir the stew of disease, I think is how you put it. So there's a spread of new diseases. We get leprosy and we get tuberculosis and other kinds of diseases as well.
That's right. And those are two very important bacterial diseases that existed before the Roman Empire, but which the Roman Empire was very conducive to the spread of.
Let's talk about the Antonine Plague, which erupts, as you explain it, in I think around the year 165, the apex of Roman power. And there's the theory that the Romans believe that when they were conquering Carthage, that, if I get this right, the soldiers had unleashed a vapor, a miasma that followed them back and brought with us this plague. Is that how it goes? Is that how the story goes?
Yes, almost. Just a different city. So in the 160s, the Romans launched a campaign against the Parthians. So this is the main power in the Near East at the time and centered in what's now Iraq. And they invade one of the really great cities of the Near East, Seleucia. And they sack the city, and then as they're looting the city, they desecrate a temple of the god Apollo. Yeah. And this angers Apollo, but it also releases a vapor. And the ancients, the Greeks and Romans alike, believe that one of the causes of epidemic disease is a miasma, is a kind of corruption of the atmosphere or a poisonous vapor. And they believe that this is unleashed out of the fury of the god Apollo and is the cause of the Antonine Plague.
What was it really? You make an argument in the book that this was smallpox?
Yes. So most every Roman historian who's worked on this thinks it's smallpox, and I do as well, but I'd be a little bit hesitant because we don't have any DNA evidence to support this. But the great Dr. Galen is alive through this plague and in several places writes about it. And it's very hard to perform what's called retrospective diagnosis, to read a second century doctor and
really who believed in humors, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a totally different mentality. So in some cases you can do it. In other cases, it's very hard when the symptoms aren't exact and a lot of diseases are relatively similar. Even smallpox, you know, it has some absolutely diagnostic symptoms. And so when you get smallpox, it causes kind of large pustular eruptions that raise up off your skin and cover your palms and the soles of your feet. That's pretty rare. And Galen doesn't say that, but he does describe black pustular rash that covers most of the body. He describes a kind of lengthy course of infection. And we know that the disease was highly contagious and spread far and fast. So we can cautiously infer that it's probably the smallpox virus, but there's still a little uncertainty about it.
Can you give us a sense, Kyle Harper, about what it would have been like at the peak, or certainly when it was raging through Rome, let's say Rome itself, the city, you know, all of that density, all of those people, what was the Antonine Plague like to live through if you were a resident of Rome?
Imagine at least in broad strokes, a city of 1 million people that live in unimaginable density and really in a mix of extreme luxury to extreme squalor. Yeah. And Rome would have had that whole spectrum, and the virus would have moved fairly indiscriminately from person to person in a world where there was no social distancing and very little understanding of contagion. And so people would have exposed each other all the while thinking that it was in the air, when in reality it was in their bodies and being ejected as they coughed, sneezed, talked, spit, and bled. And so it would have passed rapidly over the course of several months, and it would have overwhelmed the city's ability to respond. And it was probably a challenge to bury the dead and to maintain any semblance of the kind of normal pace and routines of life. So it would have been traumatic. It would have been, I think, hard for us to imagine the kind of suffering in a world without any therapies that helped at all, without any kind of painkillers. People would have died en masse in conditions that for us are almost unimaginable suffering.
One of the things you write about is how these plagues, as you put it, cracked the foundations of ancient polytheism and allowed, at least later in this story anyway, Christianity to, as you put it, creep into the open, kind of get a foothold. And I wanted to ask you about that. There's this story that I read from the religious scholar Elaine Pagels, and she talks about this moment. I think she's references the sociologist Rodney Stark, who tells this story about how the plague was ravaging cities and towns throughout the entire Roman Empire. And what most people did is they, if they could, Galen did, they got out of town since everyone was dying all around them. But that some Christians believed that God's power gave them this obligation to alleviate suffering, and so they stuck around. And Galen noticed this, and she quotes, or he quotes anyway, Stark or Pagels, I can't remember which, Galen, who wrote, "For the people called Christians, contempt of death is obvious to us every day, and also their self-control in sexual matters. But he says they also include people who, in self-discipline in matters of food and drink and in their keen pursuit of justice, have attained a level not inferior to that of genuine philosophers. In other words, he was really impressed that some of the Christians at some point during one of these outbreaks, they stayed and they helped. Do you have anything to say about that? Because I thought this was an interesting story, and you do write about the fact that the Christians were able to sort of establish a foothold during all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I think this is a really important phenomenon and is very real. And it's plausible because we know more about this from the mid-third century and the next pandemic that I have written about, the plague of Cyprian,
right,
where we do for the first time have Christian sources from the period talking about the Christian experience of and reaction to this pestilence. And very strongly advocate for Christians to care for the sick and to bury the dead. And as pagan society was struggling to respond to these mortality events, the Christian church was a tight-knit community that, judging by these texts, responded vigorously and graciously in the context of this suffering. And so the Christian sources themselves, of course, say that they do operate without fear of death and with charity for their neighbors. And certainly these kinds of traumatic social events are moments of cultural change. And one of the phenomena of the later third century in the aftermath of this plague and a more general crisis of Roman state and society is the rapid spread of Christianity.
What do we know about that second plague you refer to in the book, The Plague of Cyprian? You say it's the plague that no one really talks about.
No one talks about it. Maybe someday I'll get that to change. But it's surprising to me because this is a little bit of a dark age in Roman history. There's kind of a phase in the middle of the third century when we know the Roman Empire experiences this terrible multifaceted crisis. It's a geopolitical crisis with new and more formidable enemies, both in the east and across the northern frontiers. There's a legitimacy crisis when there's one contender for the Roman throne after another, and round after round of civil war. It's a monetary crisis when the old silver currency completely falls through the floor and becomes almost without any value. So period of extreme inflation. So it's a multifaceted crisis, but woven throughout it, and I think inseparable from the broader crisis, there's a health crisis. And it's traditionally called the Plague of Cyprian after the bishop of the city of Carthage. So it's a prominent part of a much bigger episode in Roman history that really is transformational. The Roman Empire survives this, but I think we should be careful with our hindsight not to abuse it, that history didn't have to turn out that way. This could have been the end of the Roman Empire. It could have easily fallen apart. It fell apart for a time and had to be put back together. And the Roman Empire that emerges on the other side of it is a very different kind of empire. It has a different sort of ruler. It'll ultimately have a different monetary system. Yeah. And ultimately, it will have a different religion.
Let's talk about the Justinian plague. Plague begins AD 541, I think it is. This one could be bubonic plague. Can we say with more certainty that we know this might be bubonic plague, this one?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is what's really exciting is the DNA of the germ that caused this pandemic has been found, and it is indeed bubonic plague or the bacterium Yersinia pestis, which is the same pathogen that causes the Black Death in the 14th century, which is the worst biological catastrophe in European history. So it's a bad one, and it was there, and it arrived in the broader Mediterranean region in 541 and caused devastation for several years till around 544. Then it paused, but the bacterium stayed somewhere in Western Eurasia and broke out repeatedly every 10 to 15 years, sometimes in local, sometimes in massive outbreaks for about two centuries. So this was a pandemic that sort of flickered on and off variably for a period of two centuries. We can think of it as an age of bubonic plague.
So what do we know about the impact, the mortality rate of this particular plague? I think you've said it was somewhere around, did I get this right, 50%? And we have to keep, you mentioned it, it kept coming back. It just kept happening, something like 38 times, I think you say, over the next 200 years. I mean, what impact does it have on populations? I mean, it seems like one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that it would be too simple to say disease killed the Roman Empire. I mean, it certainly tried, and they kept coming back, but it seemed like they were taking two steps forward and then disease would bring them back one step. But this Justinian plague did seem to be really critical to maybe tipping them really near extinction.
Yeah. I mean, we have very good independent eyewitness accounts, one written by a very traditional pagan, one written by a very devout Christian, who describe massive mortality. Now, it's easy to criticize sources like these, and certainly ancient sources are not always reliable. They saw the world through the cultural lenses that they wore, and you have to be appropriately cautious. But when they are looking at the same event through totally different cultural worldviews and with totally different motives in writing their history, but share the same basic set of facts, including that this was the worst mortality that they had ever seen by far, then it creates a kind of plausibility. And they both describe the high death toll, particularly in Constantinople. And one of them says that at least 230,000 were counted dead and probably more than 300,000 died. And the city of Constantinople would have had a population, we don't know, but on the order of 500,000. So that would imply something like 40-50% or 50-60% of the population.
Wow.
And he doesn't imply in any way that Constantinople was unique. In fact, all of our sources are unanimous on painting a picture of a disease that reached far and wide. It takes a special kind of stubbornness to deny that the plague was really, really bad in Constantinople, in the Greek Eastern urban capital. But we were sort of flying blind in trying to understand how far it reached in the West and whether or not it sort of got into the countryside where most people lived. Now we have archaeological DNA that tells us what kinds of places the plague reached. And indeed, it got far and wide. It has been recovered from villages in the middle of nowhere in southern Germany, in as far west as Britain. And now we have DNA evidence that would stand up in a court of law that condemns the bubonic plague of having killed people here. So it was there. And that is quite extraordinary. And it testifies to the epidemiology, to the kind of population level dynamics that this was able to transmit, not just into the big urban centers and not just around the Mediterranean, but to penetrate really far into places where a lot of people ultimately live. So it's an exciting time to be studying these kinds of events.
I have to ask you about another element in this story, which you write about in the book, and that's climate. Because if the bubonic plague isn't bad enough, then comes an ice age for the Romans. Talk a little bit about this part of the story, because it's a big part of the story, but give us a sense of that, if you would.
Yeah, so it is a big part of the story, and the quick version of it is that we're also learning a lot about the the history of climate. And the climate varied and changed before humans started ejecting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere on a massive scale. So the Romans lived through various episodes of climate change, some more important than others, but maybe the most pronounced is a period of cooling that begins quite suddenly in the 6th century, in the 530s and 540s, that we now know unequivocally is caused by a series of volcanic eruptions that induce large-scale cooling across the northern hemisphere. And this plunges the Earth system into a cooler phase that is probably the coldest decade of the last 2,000 to 3,000 years. And that's reconstructed from tree rings. And it doesn't just sort of go away, but for a period of a century, century and a half, cooler temperatures prevail. This was not only disruptive, it was also probably challenging for agricultural productivity in the Mediterranean and much of Europe. So it was bad timing, and it may have some mechanistic connection, although I have to say we don't know what it is, with the outbreak of the Justinianic plague. So it's certainly coincidental and possibly causal, but ultimately is synergistic. The climate challenges and the health challenges bore down on the people of the 6th century at the same time.
You mentioned it basically exhausted what was left of the Roman imperial order, and I was struck by this number. You say Gregory's Rome may have been home to as few as 10 to 20,000 souls huddled inside its walls. They're in Rome, where at one point there were 1 million people, now had between 10 and 20,000 people. You say they would barely have filled a corner of the Colosseum.
Right. So I just think it's staggering to imagine the change that had occurred in the city of Rome. And of course, it wasn't all plague. Yeah. That's one factor. Rome had been the center of a world empire and had fed its people with free grain shipped from Egypt and this extraordinary supply of food provision. So there's a lot going on as Rome transfers from being a world capital to a backwater. But certainly the plague is a big part of that at multiple levels. And just the overarching fact of dramatic change, I think, is staggering. And for a city that had once been the most populous city in the world to have become a kind of, hinterland of the real action in human civilization that had now shifted to the Near East is an important part of the human story.
Okay, final question. It sort of brings us back to something we were talking about before. You say in the book at the end that the primacy of the natural environment in the fate of this civilization, the one we're in now, draws us closer to the Romans. Say something about that finally, because you talk about how the Roman experience is important if we think about it as an ongoing story, not just a piece of history.
Right. And I think that there's the climate dimension of that, and then there's the disease dimension of that as well. And in some ways, we're buffered against the effects of infectious disease, particularly if you're privileged enough to live in the developed world. But this COVID pandemic reminds us that we're also vulnerable, and that part of the human story is the repeated interruption of the course of our history by these kinds of biological shocks that are the product of random genetic evolution, and the way that random and relentless process constantly intersects with the ecologies that we create. So I think what we're experiencing is part of a deeper pattern, but it's unpredictable in its consequences. And that's certainly something that's part of the Roman experience. And we can look back on that and feel like there's a certain continuity between their story and the world that we live in, even though we also have tools that they could hardly have imagined in public health and biomedicine.
Kyle Harper. He's a professor of classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma. His book is The Fate of Rome: Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.